reach for. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Tonight we're going to try to talk again about education in America. Last week we had trouble connecting up with David Marshak, but we expect him to join us tonight. And our first guest, speculative fiction writer Bruce Holland Rogers, may have something to say about it too. I was writing this on one laptop. I was connected to the other one, which I'll be doing the show, even though the other one was only about 8 feet away. Shamelessly lazy setup points to the amount of technology in many of our lives. I had a call yesterday from a friend whose technology completely failed him. I ended up making an emergency house call to help out. Now, the time was the doctors made house calls, not geeks. Doctors rarely see patients outside the office now. Computer folks that are working out of a store don't really do it all that often either, because they price themselves out of the market. Priests may still make house calls, I think. I'm not sure about that. Price themselves out of the market. You know, that's what many Americans have done. They think they're so special. They put an inordinately high price on their services, and then they're surprised and saddened when no one calls them to work. Others, not officially Americans, have undergone incredible hardship trying to get into this country. They risk their lives. They want nothing more than to work for a living real cheap. What do we think about them? Well, we think they're taking our jobs. But we didn't want the jobs. We didn't want to work for those wages. We think they're threatening our security. We want to keep them out or send them home. And then there are folks who aren't even trying to come over here, just want to do some work for dirt cheap wages just so they can get by in the discomfort of their own homes somewhere way overseas. And we think they're a threat too. The whole thing, it's all pretty crazy, because if we just did the work ourselves, it wouldn't have to be threatened by those who are willing. But you know, there's something else. If we did that work ourselves for those wages, well, we couldn't afford to continue to live in this country. Isn't that something? And here we are. We feel threatened by people who work for almost nothing because we don't want to work. because we couldn't afford to live on that salary. But I mean, what's up with this? It's this economic situation. It's completely, totally out of control. That's why our lives are completely and totally out of control. It's not getting any better. But, you know, I think it could get a lot worse. There are people out there running for office who want to shut down the few things that keep many of us alive. People out there running for office who are preying on the hidden but still volatile prejudices of many people. They want to change the face of our country still further from what we thought it was, from what we were taught it was supposed to be. There are those who are preying on our fear even while they pray for us. I almost said they pretend to pray for us, but that would be a great mistake. You see, they're not pretending. They truly believe the lies and illogic that are coming out of their mouths, and that's why they're so dangerous. We must not underestimate those who become our enemy. We must learn from them. And though we need not use their tactics, we need to understand their tactics, or we'll never be able to defeat them. They want us to be afraid. And it's actually okay, pretty normal, really, to be afraid. But they want our fear to paralyze us, to paranoid us, as it were. They want to make us crazy. But I say, don't go mad, get mad. Several years ago, Bill Hicks suggested that we could all get together and change the world. Let's listen.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Those are some great thoughts from Bill Hicks. And now, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
How you doing, Chuck? Tonight we welcome, as you said, David Marshak. I think he'll be speaking to us from Bellingham, Washington. And as you also mentioned, Bruce Holland Rogers. I think he'll be talking to us from California. So tonight we're all speaking together from Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Bellingham, California, and you, wherever you are. I'd like to quickly go over some notes here. Deborah Sweet writes from World Can't Wait. She says, "We are not your soldiers is gearing up for the fall semester to visit more high schools and colleges with veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan war. Students will learn about the vets' experiences and why they should not enlist to fight in these ongoing wars. As the occupation of Afghanistan and sanitized warfare through kill lists and drone bombings continues, no matter who will be president, we need to intervene in the lives of young people before they are signed away to the war machine." And for information, go to wearenotyoursoldiers.org. Also, Jill Stein of the Green Party is hard at it, along with her campaign manager, Ben Mansky, and they have a new TV ad, and it's pretty cool. If you Google Green Party President Jill Stein, any of that will get you to their website and take a look at the TV ad. They're also asking for donations to get the TV ad on the stations across the country. Also, Sister Ann Montgomery, she was in the first Plowshares way back 1980-something. She has passed away. Nuclear weapons pose such a grave danger to all life on Earth in the eyes of Sacred Heart Sister Ann Montgomery that she devoted more than 30 years of her life to protest their stockpiling by the world's governments. From participating in the first of the so-called Plowshares actions, September 9, 1980, until her sixth and last protest, November 1, 2009, for which she served 2 months in federal prison, Montgomery epitomized the heart and soul of a movement that has spanned the globe, several friends and fellow activists for peace said. Montgomery died of cancer August 27th at Oakwood, the Society of the Sacred Hearts Elder Care Center in Atherton, California. She was 85. And this is greetings from Kevin Barrett. Kevin Barrett is a radio show host. He lives in Wisconsin. Good friend. Thank you to everyone who contributed to my coming trip to New York to cover the 9/11 anniversary events for Press, TV, and Veterans Today. If you want to make my trip and my work a little easier, feel free to PayPal a contribution to Truth Jihad, J-I-H-A-D, at gmail.com, or mail something to P.O. Box 221, Lone Rock, Wisconsin, 53556. And if you do that, if you will Google Kevin Barrett or go to American Freedom Radio, you'll see all his great new interviews. He's got one here that he's promoting. It was a debate between two folks, Barry Chanis and Christopher Bolian, who say that Israel or Zionists did 9/11, and they agree on that, but do disagree on the details. And also, as we reported last week, put the drones on trial. We'll say again that the first federal trial on drones will feature Ramsey Clark, Colonel Ann Wright, Bill Quigley, and Kathy Kelly. They're not the defendants, but they're going to hopefully testify. Attend the September 10th trial in Jefferson City, Missouri, and demonstration at Wyman Air Force Base. Catholic worker Brian Terrell and retired Disciples of Christ minister Ron Faust were arrested April 15th at Wyman Air Force Base in Knobnostra, Missouri. They asked to give the commander an indictment of all U.S. agents involved in drone warfare, from President Obama to the crews at Wyman that direct Predator drones by remote control, charged with trespass. Terrell and Faust are preparing to put the drones on trial. Join them Monday, September 10th, at the federal courthouse at 80 Lafayette Street, Jefferson City, Missouri. And as always, go to the Nuclear Resistor, nukeresistor.org, and they've got a lot of good news, or not good news, they've got, it's a good, different news. It's there's a, one of the NATO 5 defendants was, they have a story about him being beaten by sheriffs, hospitalized, and we talked to Anthony Rayson from Chicago a few weeks back about the NATO 5 defendants. So go to the Nuke Resistor and read about that. There's also something about Sister Ann Montgomery, and also, I know I won't say this name right, but it's an Iraqi-American, Shakir Hamoudi. He's going to do federal prison time for sending relief to Iraqis in violation of the sanctions against Iraq. Remember, we had those during the Clinton years that killed so many people. So go to the Nuke Resistor and read about him. Also, go to Jim Fetzer and the Real Deal. Google Jim Fetzer, F-E-T-Z-E-R, the Real Deal. And Veterans Today website, go with Gordon Duff. We've got a lot of good news there. And as my favorite philosopher has often said, blow up your TV, throw away your paper, stop on your radio, eat a lot of peaches, and try to find Jesus on your own. Okay, then, the signs of the revolution. The revolution will not be televised. Is this the revolution? From where will it come, if it comes? The recent Plowshares action in Tennessee, the drone trial in Missouri, may be a great letter to the editor. A recent article has said that violence has risen in Chicago due to increased poverty. And maybe that is where the revolution will begin. Maybe it has already begun. 100,000 marched on the street in Washington, D.C. Some old guy refuses to stand for the national anthem at a Red Sox-Yankees game. A lone man goes to the mountains of Idaho. An old lady sends a crossed-out tax form to the IRS and says she won't pay till we get the truth about the Kennedy assassinations and 9/11. Maybe it'll come from folks like those who heckled Paul Ryan in Des Moines and those other folks who stand up in public meetings, speeches, and yell out the truth about Condoleezza Rice, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, Barack Obama, or throw shoes at George Bush. maybe it could come from the third-party candidate. What if Jill Stein of the Green Party won the presidency? Wow. Or what if they let Dennis Kucinich or Ron Paul or Bobby Kennedy actually become the president? Wow. We thought we got wow with Barack Obama. His first job out of college was with the CIA. Do you ever leave the CIA? My guess is that probably it, the revolution, capital T, capital R, comes from poverty and necessity and maybe some reading, learning, but where would the learning come from? Corporate TV? Probably the internet, some spark, some fire that just happens that was not quite planned but just seemed to work just right. Or probably it never happens, well, not until it would get very bad and very evident. Those who do these things, these government and corporate agents, are very careful about that. They're careful to say, just inside the tree line where we only think we see the shadows moving. Lots of us are advocating investigation into U.S. history. That is what I think is the most important. What if the big newspapers printed the good work of Jim Fetcher about 9/11, about the JFK murder? What if William Pepper, the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, the attorney who gave us the truth about the King murder, had a column in 100 major newspapers? That would be important. What if Kevin Barrett had the nightly news instead of Brian Williams? It would change the world. In 1 week, the world would be unrecognizable from the crap we have now. Information is important. Education is important. What if the history books in high schools and colleges gave the truth about the assassinations of the 60s? In 10 years, we could have an entirely different population and nation for the better, I believe. Some have actually found things out on their own, gotten us close to actually getting somewhere. Jim Fetzer, James Douglas, William Pepper, Mark Lane. There's hundreds of others, Leno Sanek, Jack White, Mae Brussel. Others who have researched the Zapruder film, photos in Dealey Plaza, Lyndon Johnson, George Bush. The hundreds, thousands of detailed aspects of these assassinations. The work has been done by volunteers, but it has largely not been disseminated by the media. I went into journalism thinking that it was important, but now I realize even more how important it is. Knowledge, education, ideas, consciousness do matter. They determine our actions, right? We think something, we move that way. We think Hardee's is over there, we turn right. The CIA knows that very well, and that's why they and the rich men and women who really don't know, who we really don't know, control the media. They control perceptions, and that's very clever. They have done excellent work, heavy lifting, and for that they have earned their reward, the control of the U.S. and most of the world. So from all that, I determined that this radio show matters. We don't do primary research. We really only read and try to be aware of the work others have done, and then we try to pass that along. That's a pretty big deal, we think. And so for Dave, for now, again, Jim Fetzer, James Douglas, William Pepper, Mark Lane, and Richard Belzer has a new book, Dead Wrong. And look at you can listen to his interview on Black Hop Radio. And to hell with CBS or NBC or ABC News or National Public Radio or some of those popular phony liberal websites. That may sound like paranoid conspiracy theorism. You're supposed to laugh at that, but I say it's just paying attention. And remember that Mrs. Hinderbottom told us, how are you going to learn if you're not going to pay attention, people? There is actually a they out there, and there actually is a you and a me. We are we. They, Bush, Obama, Clinton, and company want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters in 2001. We can do this, but we cannot be afraid.
The New American Dream presents an American Hero special. Recently, we honored patriotic singer-songwriter Toby Keith. Put a boot up their ass. Awesome. Then we honor General Norman Schwarzkopf, General Colin Powell, General Tommy Frank, General something-something Petraeus, all the other generals out there in charge of our patriotic military who are protecting us from people plowing mountains with oxen, killing them before they fly those oxen over here and dive bomb us with box cutters and not allow us to worship in the churches of our choice. Last week, we honored Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who uttered those words that will live forever in Catholic hymnals and on the sides of police cars, the same awesome style of Madeleine Albright speaking about the children dying in Iraq during the sanctions. We came, we saw, he died. This week, We honor all of you who stand like zombies whenever the American flag passes by in a parade or when the national anthem is played at any sporting event, from 7th grade intramural checkers to the Super Bowl. You stand without even thinking. And for that, we thank you. For if you had a brain or stop for a moment to think of what you were doing, what you're being asked to do, condone America and its wars and killing in order to steal from other nations, you'd crawl out of that stadium on your knees. In shame. For that, we salute you. You're not a prevert or murderer or insane person. You're an American hero.
Hello, I'm Tom Brady, quarterback for the New England Patriots. And because I'm afraid if I tell you the truth, I won't be able to live my good life in America and be a pro football player on TV and rich and have a car and a house and a family in America. I tell you the truth about America and its soldiers and veterans, I will be destroyed. Hello, I'm Joseph, high school football coach. I am a coward. I'm a co-conspirator in the raping and murdering and plundering of the world by America's military. I'm Anne, emergency room nurse. I am an American. I'm afraid of other Americans, really afraid. I'm Bill, your dentist. I want to be liked. I don't want to be an outcast. I'm Mrs. Thompson, your daughter's third-period English teacher. I want to be able to exist, at least exist within a thin bubble. I get one chance at living, and I'm not going to waste it by telling you the truth. And so, thank you to all of our nation's veterans and on-duty military for protecting us. You keep us free. You are heroes. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Remember the night of the Clinton inaugural balls? The singing, the dancing, the persistently endless smiling, the dreams, the hopes? Remember how they gave up on health care? Remember the omnibus crime bill, the construction of dozens of new prisons? Remember the bombing of Yugoslavia for 70 days? Remember the Welfare Reform Act, the end of ADC, NAFTA, the end of the jobs in America? Does anyone remember the pardon of Leonard Peltier? Drug running by the CIA in Mena, Arkansas. Gary Webb reports about that in the Mercury News and is later is murdered. The sanctions on Iraq that killed 1 million people. The reversal of Glass-Steagall, which is all about the 99% and the 1% in today's headlines. I won't ask, and please don't tell me if you voted for William Jefferson Clinton. Hope, change, elect Barack Obama. Remember the Democratic Party, John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy? We thought everything was possible, probable, and then they blew it all away. Clinton and Obama got the message, wouldn't you say? Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Our first guest tonight is science fiction writer Bruce Holland Rogers. Bruce is an American author who also writes under the pseudonym Hanovy Braddock, and his stories have won a Pushcart Prize, two Nebulas, Bram Stoker Award, a whole list of them. He's had films based on his stories, and he teaches writing. He also has a rather unique way of marketing his fiction. I'd like to introduce to you Bruce Holland Rogers.
Hi, Chuck. Good to be with you.
Well, good.
Am I with you?
I would, for a start here, I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about yourself. I highlighted the awards and things. So why don't you tell us who you really are, what kinds of things you write, that sort of thing.
Sure. Well, I always get introduced as a science fiction writer, and that's not surprisingly since that's the genre that I started out in most visibly. But I really see myself as I don't quite want to say jack of all trades, but I see myself as the kind of writer who enjoys being all over the literary map. So I write literary fiction, I write experimental fiction that's for a very small audience, and I write the kinds of fiction that can, find publication for mass audiences. I like playing with different genres, so I enjoy everything from mystery to horror to fantasy to realism. And, you know, politically, too, I kind of enjoy being the sort of writer who can find something to say to widely different and varying audiences. So I think I'm probably the only writer who has appeared both in Good Housekeeping and in Adbusters.
That's an interesting combination.
And I'm also very interested in the way that publishing is changing. I have heard some people who know a lot better the real financial conditions of the large publishing conglomerates who have said to me that they don't think that that model can possibly survive much longer. They look at these companies that have very large overhead expenses and have really been trying to change publishing from the industry that it used to be, where it was a lot of family-owned businesses, people who are in publishing mostly for the prestige of really being involved in the nation's culture, to corporate ownership, where everything was really all about profit margins. And we've got a model where in the last 20 years or so, increasingly, publishing is run by people who wanted to squeeze every last nickel out of it. And while there are lots of editors and people with the title of publisher in these companies who care very much about books, the people who are over them are really interested in trying to find a way to publish only lowest common denominator bestseller work. And I think that that model is not going to survive much longer.
Well, you know, I think that your description there, that's a microcosm for the way almost all industry has gone in the United States. I don't know if it's a worldwide phenomenon. It might be. But somebody put the bean counters in charge, and they're not letting go.
Well, and it's not at all surprising that, you know, that people have a profit motive. I think that sometimes we build our institutions and we build structures that give us perverse results that weren't really what we intended. You know, I have to confess, I'm rather a skeptic when it comes to the idea of hidden coordinated action and conspiracies, because I don't think you need that to get the bad results we have. I think ordinary human confusion, passion, garden variety, self-interest, these are the kinds of things that can get us the kind of trouble that we're in. And one of the areas that I look at, I think, is symptomatic of that is the compensation for CEOs of large companies. You know, the people who are on the board who are making the pay decisions for the CEOs are their golfing buddies and their school chums. And the idea of company governance providing oversight and also doing things like putting limits on the pay for the top executives, that just doesn't happen anymore. And I don't think it's because of conspiracy. I think it's just because of very ordinary human interests, the way that we tend to stick together with people who we already know and like. We tend to want to work with people who we think are similar to us, and I don't think that's an indication of bad intentions on our part. It's just sort of a human trait to want to go with what we're already comfortable with. But without some kind of system of checking that and, you know, really asking, are we getting the results that we want, then you get executives who are making, you know, I don't know, in some cases thousands of times what their typical line worker is. And I don't think those executives are actually producing thousands of times more value to the company than that person who's actually making the product.
Well, I think that's a very interesting take on the situation. We, on this show, a lot of times tend to think about you know, conspiracies as being the reason things have happened. But it's it's sometimes refreshing to hear another opinion saying that it's just greed and happenstance. However, whether or not there's conspiracies making these things happen, the fact that the great majority of us have become apathetic or afraid, that's what's created the environment that lets things happen.
I think that this sort of gets into one of the things that I think is promising about the future of publishing. I think that if it is true that the conglomerate model of mass publishing is going to begin to fall apart, what I see opening up is a lot more activity in the long tail, that part of the marketplace for culture where you have lots and lots of titles that sell modestly. So for the large companies, I know some writers who were selling mass market paperbacks and were selling 10,000 copies a book, and that's an abject failure for these large companies. But, gee, I'd be delighted if I had 10,000 reliable readers for each of my books, especially, if I'm self-publishing and getting to keep most of the profit from that. I could make a living with an audience of 10,000. In fact, I think I could make a living with an audience of 2,000. And I think that with the electronic distribution of texts and the ways of being able to reproduce texts inexpensively, it's possible for writers to sell their work more cheaply than a conglomerate publisher would charge for it. And yet, because they're keeping most of that money themselves, to be able to make a living with a much smaller audience. And I think that this is really democratizing the opportunity of writers to reach readers. We still have to work out exactly how readers find the better writers. And I know that lots of readers have probably had the experience of reading something that was self-published and not wanting to repeat the experience. So we still need reviewers,
I'm sure,
or
that's
bloggers,
true, but,
or somebody that helps sort this out.
I read a lot of self-published work, and I don't know whether the people are selling or giving away mostly 10 copies or 10,000 copies, and I'm not sure that the number sold actually tracks the quality, but I found there was a while when the quality seemed to be going down. It was like people didn't bother to edit their work. They just threw it up there. They'd thrown something down on the paper or the computer and didn't care at all. But then recently, I think because it's becoming more popular, people are having to do a better job, and I find an awful lot of really good stuff out there. Not that there aren't still some of the things that I don't get through, but I'm pretty encouraged with this. I don't know, it's not exactly crowdsourcing, because that would imply one work by many people, but The number of writers that are actually being heard is definitely on the increase in this new environment.
I agree with you, and I think that we're seeing more and more self-published or independently published writers who are understanding the value of hiring an editor, which, there are plenty of unemployed editors out there, too.
Absolutely.
and it's great to find somebody who has those skills, who can spot the little errors in your manuscript that you can't see anymore because you know what it's supposed to say.
Absolutely. I I've been blessed with some of those skills, and so I do editing for people, and I enjoy it. It really gives a great chance to find new things. I'd like you to tell listeners about how you're marketing your short fiction.
Well, the main thing that I'm doing is I have a website, shortshortshort.com, because I write especially very short stories. They're sometimes called short stories or flash fiction. And since 2002, I've posted some of my stories as samples on that site, but the site is mostly there describing the subscription service that I have, where readers pay me $10 for a year of stories, and in that year they get 3 stories a month, 36 stories for the year. And these are stories that allow me to move from genre to genre and still keep the same audience. So I have readers who are reading not because they're particularly fans of science fiction or particularly fans of literary fiction, but because these are all stories by Bruce Holland Rogers, and they've read enough of my work to discover that they kind of like the way that I see the world and the way that I reflect that in my fiction. And at $10 a year, right now I've got about 500 subscribers. If I could get that up to 2,000 subscribers, then that would be an example of, I think, making a living from that really rather fairly small audience, certainly in national terms. But still being free to write exactly the kind of work that I want to do.
Well, I think that's a great idea, a great model for other people to follow. Of course, you have to get that following first, and you had a lot of things published by the big publishers and awards and all that, so that certainly
that's true. So I had an advantage there, but I also started this with what sounds like a sort of pyramid scheme, where I went to the first few subscribers, which I started with friends and family, and I said, if I can get 4 of you to subscribe, I'll write a story that I will email you, and I'll write them at the rate of 1 a year. And if then I can get 16 of you to subscribe, then I'll write a story quarterly. And I kept, adding the number of stories that I would write according to how many subscribers I had. And that got me built up pretty quickly to the level of, it was probably about 150 subscribers, and I was writing 2 stories a month. And at that point then, I figured I was within sight of what would be the limit for me for being able to write good stories. So I said, okay, I'm going to increase it to 3 stories a month, no matter how many subscribers I have. And that's how I proceeded from there. So, there are very different strategies you can take for getting started. And I would say the best strategies are ones that start with those people who already know and like your work and would like to show you some support, and then trying to build in some kind of incentive for them so that, the more supporters you have, the more reward they get out of that as well.
Well, I think it's great to hear someone with a certain stature in the field encouraging self-publishing, because I really do think that's the way that things are going to go. As you say, you've got to get the thing edited because you probably can't find your own mistakes. But the costs have to go down, and self-publishing is the way to make that happen.
Absolutely.
So,
I do want to give you one other example of a writer who is self-publishing, a rather surprising example. Living in Eugene, Oregon. That's where I'm calling you from now. And another Eugene, Oregon writer is Kate Wilhelm, who is a multiple award-winning novelist. I'm glad that you know her name, heard of her.
I love her work, yeah.
Well, Kate has most recently been publishing mostly mystery novels, and she'd been with St. Martin's Press for a long time. And she looked at the last contract that they offered her, and she just shook her head and said, I can't sign this. You want too much for too little. And she then went to an incorporation attorney to show her how to set up a limited liability company. And now Kate is reacquiring all of the rights of all of her out-of-print books, and she will self-publish all of her old books, but all of her new titles, too, will come out from this small press. So some very well-known,
so
very
is there a new Barbara Holloway novel on the way?
Yeah, I think actually the next Barbara Holloway novel that comes out will be from Kate's own imprint, her own small press.
Well, that is very interesting news. And hey, folks, you heard it here. Bruce, thank you for visiting with us. We're out of time, but it's been a very interesting conversation, and maybe we'll talk to you again in a few months.
Chuck, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, and have a good night.
Bye-bye.
And now, we bring you the New American Dream masterpiece classic, Playhouse Theater something something. Real voices with a message you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News. This interview was conducted at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco on Monday, March 18, 1968, between the Underground Argo newspaper and comedian Mort Saul.
Argo, why is the truth behind the assassination of President Kennedy the last chance of America for its survival?
Because the evidence, this is Mort Saul, because the evidence developed by District Attorney Garrison indicates that certain people had to take President Kennedy's life in order to control ours. In other words, as Richard Starnes of the New York World Telegram said, the shots in Dallas were the opening shots of World War III. There's been a great change in this country since Kennedy. I'm afraid a great deal of our hope was interred with his remains.
What is the long, hard night that America must go through that you've spoken of?
She has to hang on through a period of the military and the CIA with a blank check trying to sell fascism. If she can hang on long enough, Americans may yet live in the country in which they were born, the country structured by Tom Paine and Tom Jefferson.
What is the renaissance following this long, hard night that you've also spoken about?
We'll start pursuing the American dream again. I don't know if we'll ever realize it, but we're supposed to have the right to pursue it, and that's what this country is. It's an active exercise in man reaching his upper limit, and the renaissance will be that a groundswell of public opinion will flush out the rascals because the CIA has infiltrated every area of our national life. I'm afraid the country they subverted best was the United States, be they in various right-wing churches or in the Dallas Police Department.
What will make the American people face themselves and, to use your expression, rise up like an army?
Well, they have very decent instincts. If they didn't, the government would not have to hide facts from them. And so once the truth is revealed to them, they're no longer under a cloak of ignorance. Public opinion will change things. There will be a groundswell. These people will resign or will be lost in the shuffle. But you know, the country was structured so we could have violent change without violent overthrow. I'm very optimistic in that sense. The principles of America may be better than the group currently practicing or ignoring them, as you will, but the country has great resilience. Once they get the information, they may yet have time to save themselves.
Why is the trial that Mr. Garrison is pursuing really the trial of the American people?
Because we have to decide. Once the neo-fascists became bold enough to slay the president on the street, they showed their hand. They showed how arrogant they'd become, and now it's a question of symptom. That crime was a national symptom. If we we can turn our back on that, we'll pay a terrible price. It'll be the end of this democracy. As a matter of fact, it's been dying since Kennedy's death. We have to cleanse our soul. It's much the same as the French when they regained their national honor, not by framing Dreyfus, but by admitting that they did.
What does Garrison mean? The key to the whole case is through the looking glass. Black is white, white is black.
He means that the first thing the government did when the president was killed was to ratify his death and appoint a group of honorable men to initial a fraudulent report, to eventually say there's no fourth bullet, even though there's a fourth bullet hole. The man was shot at from three sides, but there was only one side. In other words, the government decrees it is so. But eventually, the government may be forced to form a ministry of truth, which will rule there was no John Kennedy if it becomes convenient. That's what he means. When Lyndon Johnson says to us, as an example, we have to continually keep up brush fire war to protect the peace. Well, that's Orwell. War is peace, and peace is war, and love is hate. And you finally sell it just that way, the contradiction. And you do it by making the American people mad, because those are the mouthings of a madman. We can be driven mad. It's the same virus that bit the Germans.
Now I'd like to welcome our second guest, David Marshak. David is the author of Kids Need the Same Teacher for more than 1 year. He has learned about the value of multi-year classrooms from more than 30 years of experience as a parent, teacher, school administrator, and researcher. He'll share some of his ideas and the motivation for his strong belief in looping. David, are you there?
I am. Hi.
David, hello. This is Mike Polacek. Could you tell me what is looping? I guess I should know, but I do not know what that is.
Well, looping is when kids stay with the same teacher from one grade to the next. So from first grade to second grade or fourth grade to fifth grade. This is commonly called looping in the school business.
And is that how many schools in the U.S. have something like that?
Well, the prevalence of multi-year classrooms is pretty small in terms of the percentage of overall schools, but it's not uncommon, and I'm sure there are looping teachers in districts all over the country. It tends to be something that teachers create rather than people at administrative levels, and it's often created by teachers because they understand that if they get a chance to work with kids for more than 1 year, they can be a lot more successful with children and also have deeper and more satisfying relationships with them.
Where did you teach in? Just tell us where you were a teacher at.
Sure. I actually started out teaching in New Hampshire. I had the great gift of starting my career by creating an alternative high school and had the experience of working with students who were mostly dropouts or force outs from the public high school for a couple of years. And that really gave me some initial experience with this. I then went and taught in a large public high school in Connecticut and found the opposite experience, that the relationships that I had with kids were very constrained by the structure of the school, by the fact that every 44 minutes kids moved to a new teacher, and that for the most part you would only work with students for 1 year and then you would never see them again. So I also got introduced to the multi-year classrooms as a parent. My stepdaughter was in two classrooms, one for 2 years and one for 5 years, that really led me to see the value of this. And then I was a district administrator in a public school district in Vermont where we had a lot of multi-year classrooms, and I was able to support teachers in creating them. And finally, I spent 14 years at Seattle University teaching and doing a lot of research about multi-year classrooms and also supporting teachers in those classrooms.
You have a ton of experience then, and this all experience then led you to write the book, Kids Need the Same Teacher for more than 1 year. And I was, can you tell us about the book and how it's doing?
Sure.
And where people might get it?
Well, you know, we have a lot of criticism in our society about schools, and we have a lot of people who are experts or who believe they're experts. And one of the policy problems that we have is that for the most part, the people making policy, so the people in government, the people in Congress, the people in the state departments of education, are people who don't have adult experience working with children or teenagers in school. So there's this cultural gap between policymakers who have one idea about how to get things done and people who actually spend their adult lives working with children in schools. So I wrote this book because I wanted to take this one idea. There are a lot of ideas about relationship, and I've worked with different aspects of the way that relationship is central. For example, another way that relationship is central in schooling is that we know that if you take ninth graders in high school and you assign them to a faculty member who will be their faculty advisor for 4 years, and you make this advising part of the job of the teacher so that it's not an extra thing, but it's a central part of what they do, we know that we can dramatically reduce the dropout rate in public high schools because one of the reasons that kids drop out in high school is because they feel anonymous. They feel that nobody knows them, nobody cares about them, and what they're doing in school has no meaning to them in the present, so they might as well drop out. So the key is relationship. And so when I wrote this book, I wanted to focus just particularly on elementary and middle schools. And so what the book offers, it explains to some extent why we have this crazy idea that every June kids have to say goodbye to their teacher after 9 or 10 months, and then every September start a relationship with a perfect stranger, and they do this 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 times in their career. And so I explain the historical origins of this, and then what I've done really is offer 4 case studies, 4 public schools in the Seattle area that I spent a good deal of time in each, 2 elementary schools and 2 middle school programs. And I describe the programs, and then I offer a lot of insight into what's going on through interviews with the teachers and the parents.
When did the book come out?
The book is actually just came out this year, and you know, so it's just available now, and you can get it in a print format from wherever you get print books, or you can get it in an ebook format from wherever you get ebooks. It's available in all the different formats.
Is there a website people can go to
sure.
find out more about you or the book?
Mm-hmm. The website is kidsneedthesameteacher.net, and this offers some additional information related to the book. One of the other elements in the book that is actually in the last chapter is that I describe how parents can do something about this situation. For the most part, particularly given the kind of high-stress test environment that our policy leaders and politicians have created in public schools, this kind of really profound cultural change is not going to come from people in the political arena, at least not anytime soon. So what I suggest to parents and describe in the last chapter in the book is that the way, if they read the book and they just understand the wisdom of this, it's pretty obvious if you think about it and you have children and you know teachers. So it's not a particularly complex concept. It's just that we don't do it. So the way to get schools to begin to respond to this is parents, if you want to have your child in a multi-year classroom, the first step is to go and talk to the principal of the school and ask the principal to provide this, and they'll probably say no. And then what you need to do is that you need to engage some other parents who want the same thing. So this may take some work through the PTA or through communication with other children's parents in your child's classroom. But basically, if you show up in the principal's office with 20 parents, the principal might actually respond to you and say, well, we'll try to make this happen, or they might say, no, we can't do it. And if they do, then you need to gather up some more parents and start talking to your school board members and start talking to your district superintendent. Two of the schools that I write about were started by parent groups in the Seattle area in exactly this way. And I know of a number of other schools where multi-year programs were created, multi-year classrooms were created through groups of organized parents who went to get, you know, gathered together critical mass and then worked through the system to get their public school administrators to respond to them. Or another way to do it, of course, would be to start a charter school or to get charter school leaders to respond to you if you have charter schools in your area.
Thank you, David, for your time and for your work. And could you tell us one more time the name of the book and where people can go to get it?
Sure. The book is called Kids Need the Same Teacher for More Than 1 Year, and you can get it in print anywhere that print books are available. And you can get the ebook in any format that ebooks come.
Thanks a lot, David. Thanks for talking to us, and have a good night.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Okay. Yep, see you later. Now, to honor America, please stand. Every one of you out there washing your car, sitting on the toilet, polishing your coin collection, driving your cars, sitting in the confessional, please stand. And to honor the coming war with Iran, please remove your hat. To honor the coming shock and awe, the awesome slaughter of a whole new batch of brownish people with high-tech weapons paid for by single mothers with 9 jobs dropping off their children at daycare at 5 in the morning, please remove your shoes. To honor those journalists on our television side, or inside our radios, in our newspapers who work diligently each day to bring us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, please remove your shirt. And now, ladies and gentlemen, to honor the wise and discerning and courageous leaders of our nation who will lead us in this coming slaughter of babies, infants, toddlers, young adults, mothers, fathers, and old people, please remove your pants, your dresses, your underwear. And now at this time, please turn to the gigantic American flag rippling in the breeze at the north end of the stadium. Turn around and bend over and repeat after me. God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. Occupy Dealey Plaza, that's where it all began, November 22nd, 1963, about 12:30 p.m., 50 years ago. Fill Dealey Plaza with protesters and signs and singing and speaking, and let them bring their dogs and their cops and their robbers and murderers and sniper rifles and double secret video cameras and microphones. Occupy Dealey Plaza. We demand a truth commission to replace the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission. We want freedom. We want peace. We want real hope and real change. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let them know we know what they have done. Occupy Dealey Plaza. Let the world know this is America.
And now we bring you the New American Dream Masterpiece Classic Playhouse Theater Something Something. Real voices with a message that you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News. Here's George Carlin. God bless America! Once again, respectfully, I say to myself, what the beep does that mean? God bless America, is that request? Is that a demand? Is that a suggestion? Politicians say with the end of every speech, as if it were some sort of verbal tick they can't get rid of. God bless you and God bless America. God bless you and God bless America. I guess they figure if they leave it out, someone's going to think they're bad Americans. Let me tell you a little secret about God, folks. God does not give a flying bleep about America. Okay, he doesn't care. He never cared about this country, never has, never will. He doesn't care about this country anymore. He cares about Mongolia, Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Suez Canal, the North Pole. Simply doesn't care, okay? He doesn't care. There are 200 countries in the world now. These people honestly think that God is sitting around picking out his favorites? Why would he do that? Why would God have a favorite country? And why would it be America out of all the countries? Because you have the most money? Because he likes our national anthem? Maybe it's because here we have 18 delicious flavors of classic Rizzaroni. It's delusional thinking. America is not alone with this sort of delusions. Military cemeteries around the world are packed with brainwashed dead soldiers who were convinced that God was on their side. America prays for God to destroy our enemies. Our enemies pray for God to destroy us. Somebody's going to be disappointed. Somebody's wasting their time. Could it be everyone? Now, people want to say, God bless America. That's their business. I don't care. Here's what I don't understand. If they say, God bless America, presumably they believe in God. And if they do, they must have heard that God loved everyone. That's what he said. He loved everyone. He loved them equally. Why would these people ask God to do something that went against his own teachings? You know what these God bless America people ought to do? They ought to check with that Jesus fellow they're so crazy about. They're always talking about what would Jesus do. They don't want to know so they can do it. They just want to know so they can tell other people to do it. Well, I'll tell you what Jesus would have done. He would have gone up on the top of the Empire State Building and said, God bless everyone around the world forever and ever till the end of time. That's what Jesus would have done. That's what these people should do, or else they should admit that God bless America is really just some sort of empty slogan with no real meaning except for something vague like good luck. Good luck, America. You're on your own, which is a little bit closer to the truth.
In some serious, actual, real, authentic journalism reporting stuff, CBS News reports with one of their reporters that the banned flight list has doubled in recent years to 21,000 people because of their threat to national security. Oh, my. Also reported was the banned walking list, now at 35,109. The banned sitting list remains at 19,412. The banned digging up the backyard with a wooden spoon to find your old high school diary list is at 14,317. The banned turning right during a red light onto any street named Honeycomb Lane is now at 15,996. The banned eating zucchini while watching elephants in a Midwestern zoo is now at 17,000, a jump from 16,400 in December, an increase of 0.7%, which was an increase of 0.8% from the prior number of 15,123.
And make sure to watch this next Wednesday night on CBS after the news. Are you smarter than an American journalist?
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. There have been more burials at sea. The second grade class at St. Nancy's will be buried at sea on Labor Day, the day before the start of fall classes, of course, with signed letters from their parents. The 9th Volunteer Ladder Division volunteered to have free everything on the dollar menu at McDonald's for one full hour and then to be buried at sea. And the sons of MIA and TSA and BSA and the XXXL size guys and gals motorcycle club will also be buried at sea on Labor Day. And it is because of this that we are free today, thanks to their sacrifice. And we finally got closure on the whole Jesus Liberty thing. Can you believe it? We thought for a long time that he was killing the Democrats of Orange Alert County. The Democrats seemed to be dying off, and for the longest time, everybody thought it was Jesus Liberty and his terrorist gang who was doing it. We had scarecrows and water tower sitters and undercover chief judges deployed to try to capture him in his operative cells. We had embedded journalists. and embedded bed testers and embedded Walmart greeters and French fry makers on the lookout for 10 years, 10 long years of undaunted, unlimited freedom and glory and being all we could be. But sometimes there's a man who, well, he's a man for his time and place. He fits right in there. And that's Jesus Liberty in Liberty, Nebraska. Jesus Liberty killed the Democrats of Orange County, Nebraska. They are no more. People say, if that's what the Democrats are about, terrorism and such, then I'm not having anything to do with them. There are those who might have had leanings toward the Democrats who might have voted with them and now will not. And there are those, almost all the people, who are Republican anyway. And there are the Democrats who won't talk about 9/11 or JFK or RFK or stolen elections, who are dying, dead, embalmed, rouged, lipsticked, suited up, casketed, memorialized, buried, drank to, and forgotten. And the terrorists in the Jesus Liberty gang got another one Saturday morning.
Dick Hardwick grabbed his chest with both hands and passed out while mowing his front lawn. He thought it might be for the last time of the summer if he was lucky, and, well, he was right. He fell face first onto the lawn boy, lay there sizzling for 10 minutes before his wife found him, his nose and left cheek barbecued, medium well, some say. Monday they had a big funeral, St. Lucie's. Fueled by Father Saul's sermon, a lot of anger spilled out at the front door and down the brick steps after that. Dick was somebody's brother. I can sympathize. I'm not from Liberty. I'm from Freedom. That's about, well, the ways down the road. I have today off from work, and I think I'll drive over to Scribner this afternoon to visit two sisters who still live there, Lola and Lila. Another sister, Layla, lives in Greeley. We had a brother, Anthony, who died at birth in Canton, South Dakota. We drive through Canton when we go to Sioux Falls. The cemetery is up on a hill on the west edge of town. Dad and Mom couldn't afford a grave. When I heard I had a brother, I was a senior in high school. I drove right over there with my dog. We walked all over that effing cemetery in the hot, hot sun. Couldn't find it. And Mom says, when I get home, there probably wasn't one. It was a shoebox and a hole, like you might bury a puppy. That was the best they could do. Mom said it was because of bad roads and not so great shock absorbers on the Ford, or maybe a Model T. I forget what it was, she said. It's sad. I try not to think about it so much. Anyway, as I was saying, John and Jones, Dick's brothers, ran down those steps, stripping their ties, screaming like they were going to kill Jesus Liberty after the priest recounted what everybody already knew about the letter to the editor. Jesus wrote that the new girl editor printed. It said the United States did 9/11 on its own, all those who went to Iraq and Afghanistan did it for nothing. And then the father said someone said that somebody's cousin saw Jesus Liberty in town. After everybody heard a while back, he'd left to go back where he came from, like they all should do. Lots of guys walked home right then. Some ran, left their families at the church. Some shoved the families into the SUVs and squealed the tires to get home. They all met back at the Legion parking lot, firing shotguns into the sky, divided into groups. Jumped and scrambled, fell into pickups and SUVs and fire engines and police cruisers to find the terrorist Jesus Liberty. Everyone wore orange. Orange caps, hats, vests, coats, jackets, gloves, pants, chaps, boots, sunglasses, socks, long johns, briefs, lighters. A blaze orange Ford pickup full of men sped off for the old hobo camp from the 30s by the railroad track south of the water tower on East Avenue. Some guys in a camo blazer spun around the post office corner, headed for the alley behind Furniture Twins. A loud blaze lime cougar puffed blue-gray smoke and squealed and smoked the tires and swerved down Main through the red light straight to the old wooden bridge over Broad Bottom Creek.
I walked into Hy-Vee and found Jesus Liberty placing boxes of All Brand into plastic bags for Mrs. Zylstra. They laughed together as Jesus put one box in upside down. I walked up to Jesus and asked him how it was going. You back in town then? Yeah. He wore that blaze red Hy-Vee uniform shirt and tan nameplate, Jesus. I stood next to him and he was tall, handsome, and his stone black hair was combed straight back, wet looking. So?
I was in Mexico. He smiled, putting in Mrs. Salstra's all-wine box and her all-spice and her all-haddock. People there are so poor. Stayed with my uncle. I walked to Chiapas over the border on my own. Small girl with a paper doll told me how to find someone who told me where to go up the mountain to find Comandante Marcos. I walked with Jesus as he pushed Mrs. Zylstra's cart to the parking lot. She wanted to talk about whether or not Jesus should have his tie hanging loose or pulled tight. I moved in between her and Jesus in the grocery cart, making her go way around the white van in the parking lot light to finally find us again, if she ever did. I stayed with them in the mountains, said Jesus, in the jungle, Mexican. My people, intellectual revolutionaries, taking up arms against injustice, making a difference. They're on the edge, pushing the envelope. Writing for international publications, invited to speak in universities around the world, in between living in a tent, sleeping on hard-packed ground, being eaten alive by mosquitoes the size of a child's hand, eating beans and more beans, killing and willing to be killed in order that poor people might live a better life. Fighting the same rich people who are everywhere, same as here, who attack their own country, same as rich people do everywhere. He looked at me as if I should know what comes next, and then gave me the answer. What else could there be in life? Jesus stopped his cart. We stood in the middle of the dark Hy-Vee parking lot away from the one light, with Mrs. Zylstra looking for us. He stared at me as if I should know the answer. Well, of course not. Still, I didn't know. I didn't know what he wants me to understand. I knew who the Huskers played next week, how long my lawn was, to whom I must talk in order to get my mail delivery restarted after vacation, of Chiapas, beans, and a child's hand. I knew not. I knew that Jesus Liberty was talking to me in a parking lot, and he was not shooting an AK-47 in Chiapas. I asked him why he was here then. Marcus told me to go back to Mount Liberty in Nebraska, to my parents. He told me to get an education, get acne, get my heart broken. He said, then come to me or write to me. For now, don't worry about it. I got this. Jesus smiled big, hoisted Mrs. Zylstra into the toddler seat in the grocery cart and pushed her to her car, which we couldn't find for a while, quite a while. We all laughed. Mrs. Zylstra kicked her feet and put her head back and smiled like her face might explode from being happy. I suppose that could happen. I've never seen it. Anyway, Jesus told me as he stood by my car while I found my keys that he was going to community college, and he hoped he might be able to open a branch restaurant in a town nearby and work with his parents. I said, cool, dude, because I thought I needed to say something. Other than, you're the most incredible person I ever met, and walking around this grocery store parking lot in the dark has been the epiphany of my life. more profound, perhaps, than the birth of my children or the death of my tarantula. We shook hands. He walked back, and I pulled out, watching inside the store as Jesus smiled and joked and helped the next customer to put crap into a bag to take home. I smiled because Jesus' liberty was going to be young for a while yet. He was perhaps not going to be robbed of a future by bandits. Not today.
I moved slowly onto the highway, past the support our troops sign on the pharmacy, turned left in front of a Schwann's truck and pedaled along home slowly, thinking about Jesus' liberty and I guess lots of stuff. I needed to lose 10 pounds, maybe 15. And maybe we were overdrawn, maybe not, and I'd like to have a quart of beer, but then that maybe would be pretty alcoholic of me. I don't know.
Just as I came to the stop sign at 7th Street, the radio blared out the 9 o'clock news music. The announcer said that several men were dead tonight near Mount Liberty, Nebraska. They'd been walking in a soybean field in the dark in search of terrorists. I drove slowly down my street, barely bouncing over the big bump in the intersection at Jefferson Avenue. They'd circled a suspect and closed in on it, a man who later turned out to be one of their own group. I pulled slowly into our driveway. The wife had left on the big yard light to remind me. We had a possum in the garage. Of course I remembered. I never, ever forget. I hated the big yard light. Thought it might make it easier for the possum to attack, drop on my head as I pulled into the garage, put its paws over my eyes. I can't see it. Run into something. Shots splashed in the night all around the circle. I pulled into the garage, shut off the engine, but left the key turned to accessory. I listened partially while keeping an eye open for ninja possum asshole. Minutes later, 8 men lay dead. Dead in the soybeans. $8.67 a bushel. Many of them Democrats. From Orange County, Iowa, this is Melissa Montoya. Back to you, Dave.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs. All the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security part-time summer help bounty hunters are about average.
And that's it for another New American Dream radio show. We thank you for tuning in. We hope you'll be back with us again next week, same time, same place. We'd like to thank thespiritualun.org, worldnewstrust.com, and june2508.com, all of whom have helped to sponsor our show. Anyone wanting to make a contribution, help us bring this show to you, please visit our website, theshow.newamericandream.info. Thanks, Mike. Have a good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.